Hello, is anyone on the line? Hello. Okay, we're ready to switch it over.
Anybody say here? You can hear me that? Yeah, I gotta work with that whole second.
I'm Mary Guest. The Global Regulatory Policy for Plasma Protein Therapeutics Association.
And the recombinant analogs. And we had member companies in the other two sessions, so by default, I became a randomized clinical trial. Therapies for different indications.
I'm David Hickam. I'm the Director of Clinical Effectiveness Research at PCORI.
I thank you all. I'm Brian. I just gave Brian Lewis, the Chief Science Officer at PCORI. I'm Adrian Hernandez. That's a cardiologist at Duke University and the Corning Center QPI.
Hi, I'm Kate O'Beale, newly elected to the chairperson of this group. I'm from GSK, and I lead the Value Evidence and Outcomes Group, formerly the Global Health Outcomes Group at GSK.
Okay, I'm Michael Galagina at Bristol Myers Squibb. I head up the U.S. Public Omics Outcomes Research Group there in the U.S. Medical Organization.
Hi, I'm Anastasia Dyfelis from Janssen Pharmaceuticals. I'm the Chief Scientific Officer for North America, and I lead up the Scientific Affairs Group, which includes health economics and a subgroup that does randomized pragmatic trials. Their goal.
I'm Peter Merkel. I'm the PI of the Vascular Patient Power Research Network, and I'm the Executive Committee of PCORI. I'm a rheumatologist and a clinical and translational investigator at the University of Pennsylvania.
Russell Albert, I'm the PI of the Mid-South CDRN, and I'm the Executive Committee for PCORNET, and I'm a primary care physician and direct the Center for Health Services Research at Vanderbilt.
Sebastian Schneider, I'm a joint internist and pharmacoepidemiologist. I'm running the Division for Pharmacoepidemiology at the Brigham Women's Hospital, Harvard Medical School. I am on the Methods Committee for PCORI. I'm also involved in MediCentral, and I think I'm on the Skills Network that is Harvard-driven, one of these PCORI.
You are. Obviously,
I'm funded on it. So, we have 2 hours to discuss a very huge topic. I mean, there's a broad breadth of experience in this room. From my perspective, I'm here because we at GSK are really interested in pragmatic clinical trials. We're currently setting one up in the diabetes area, and we're also conducting a trial in the UK in lung diseases in Salford, Manchester. So we, having had some experience in this area, we started the sulfur lung study pre-approval of the medicine. We find that it is easy to conceptualize a large pragmatic clinical trial, but much, much more difficult to actually conduct one. And so that's kind of where I like to go, but I guess maybe it would be interesting to go around the room to see what are the specific issues that we think that we should discuss here today that would be relevant to PCORNET, realizing that we only have 2 hours and we should maybe boil it down to 2, maybe 3 different areas that could be actionable and have some follow-up that we could recommend. So I'll open the floor.
Can I just say something else?
Something that I think I mentioned earlier. I think you should think of it in 2 ways. One is continued queries as to what PCORNET in its present and sort of conceptual basis now going forward, it's just to clarify, you know, what can you do, what are you thinking about, other sort of stuff. But the other is talking to PCORNET. From your perspective, from the industry's perspective, what do you need? What does your company need? What is the what is your ideas of a successful infrastructure that would allow for randomized controlled trials that are useful to you and the patients and to the stakeholders you have to deal with?
So would anyone like to start off with specific questions, issues, or hurdles that you think would be important to
now raise an issue for discussion, which we touched on a little before, which is you know, we're building tools very much to support pragmatic trials, trials that are embedded into clinical care with very broad eligibility criteria, giving providers some leeway in what they do after initial randomization, perhaps. We're not absolutely wedded to that model. I suspect a lot of the trials we end up doing will be more of a hybrid between a traditional clinical trial and a full-fledged pragmatic trial. But right now in the CDRN, what I haven't been building is the capacity to do a full-fledged, like, phase 4 clinical trial for a new indication or something in terms of the FDA regulatory needs. And so, you know, I think that's something that would be important to hear from people in this room about what kind of trials you guys are interested in, what kind of infrastructure do we need to build that would be most helpful for where you guys are thinking of going.
The other thing related to that is actually, are there regulatory barriers that you see that actually would need to be overcome for using the coordinate evidence, essentially? So are there issues there? Because I think there is certainly, it is important to understand if there are any kind of regulatory barriers that you see that we can actually try to address in a proactive fashion, so, and you know, specifically around the FDA.
Those two comments relate to one of my principal questions, which would be that if we were to conduct trials, one form of dissemination is through the published literature, but another, you know, critical and potentially more fundamentally important mode of dissemination is through providing the data to the FDA and having an impact on the label, and that does require having a data, you know, a validated type of database that's maintained, you know, per CF. I'm going to, you know, through the Code of Federal Regulations, I'm not going to say which numbers, and that ultimately would make the data, you know, more sort of, and also the degree to which it's monitored and checked, and there are ways where the FDA can be flexible, particularly in the phase 4 realm, but in thinking about how to use a randomized controlled trial and being able to embed that level of data, a quality assurance could make a really big difference, and that would be a good question is how we do that.
So can I suggest we take this and run with this a little bit and let's drill backwards? So I think, you know, Russell said phase 4, I said, well, what about phase 3? And he said, well, I think those are very different things. Actually, I think for phase 4 aftermarket, you do label extension or safety, that's, I think, it's easier to envision at this point for this kind of virtual longitudinal cohort, phase 3 or 2. So I'm going to bring these two apart. I think your concerns about the FDA issues are probably relevant to, or always relevant, but they're relevant to phase 3. So even if you should try either 2 or 3, where you are giving a novel agent or not so novel agent, and you need to collect quality data that can be that's auditable. So, yeah, I think it's not. So what components of the QuadEd, and when I say that they could include people in specific or CDRN or both, would be useful? This is a kind of way to sort of drill backwards. I would say easier things, finding patients, you know, recruitment, screening for eligibility, and screening for people who want to do it, and like, you know, who actually wants to do it, willingness to join. And then collecting those data in an efficient manner to screen, because actually what's very expensive is to find patients, and you want to get rid of patients who aren't going to be appropriate for the study. And then, so I think that's good to be able to stop them at each level. Do people have questions about our ability to do that? So screening patients, getting patients. Remember, you can go both ways. We can actually push questions. So we can use the common data model and say, do you have 446.4, which is green and discipline, yes, do you have IUI, good critical data, and this or that?
Yeah.
You get those people, we can then push a question or pull a question right to them and say, do this, that, or anything.
Yeah, so it may be useful to break it down into different pieces, because if we could utilize PCORnet for recruitment, into a traditional clinical trial, that would also be useful. So the difference there would be that the sites may not be the same depending on the capabilities of the sites, which is okay. So phase three and phase four, at least in my book, the data quality has to be the same because phase four often has, so don't throw data quality out the window just for phase four. But there are different, and then there could be other trials that we do for payers, and that it was brought up earlier today, that it still has to be quality, but it may, the level of uncertainty, as we were talking about a little bit earlier, may be more acceptable because it's a real-world setting. So you could break it down into different pieces and discuss each one of those. And I don't know if that's been thought about in BCornet before in terms of utilizing different parts of the process rather than just investing in a whole trial.
I mean, I think we can do that. I mean, I listed sort of our services that we're trying to provide, and you can go to our website and sort of request those because we're an infrastructure support tool, basically. So, you know, we don't, ideally, of course, we would love to do the pragmatic trials, the comparative effectiveness research trials. That's what PCORE has built us to do, so that is a priority for us. But I think that, you know, we could work with a CRO or into a traditional clinical trial where maybe our primary role is just around the patient identification component, or it's just around collection of PROs electronically on top of a traditional trial. So, you know, we view it as we're building out a variety of tools, which include informatics tools. It includes some regulatory capacity to do stuff across our whole network, and also stakeholder engagement tools. And it's not an all-in-one kind of a package. You can potentially just say, well, we only need this for this component, as opposed to saying, you know, we need you to do the whole thing. We'd love to do the whole thing, but I think we're available for both.
Right. And so maybe just along those lines, so like the issues you brought up is that the ultimate use of the data, so like, you know, what are the assurances in terms of the quality of data? So that sounds like it's going to be an important thing here, because whether the audience is label expansion or label enabling for FDA, whether it's for payers in terms of proof of evidence for, you know, real-world practice, or whether it's for healthcare systems as they're going towards accountable care organizations, having evidence on the evidence, so to speak, that this is high-quality data is an important thing. The other thing in terms of the hybrid approach that Russell's mentioning, again, you know, getting into the theme of being adaptable, is that like recognizing that like for certain questions that you know, is going to be necessary. But if you take the model of like going through a centralized IRB, centralized contracting, centralized cohort finding, those kind of things, that seems like that would be an important set of steps, you know, but you guys would have to tell us if that would be valuable or not.
Yes, so the fact that you could get a centralized designated IRB, many people will kiss you. I mean, that's really phenomenal.
Yeah.
And that can make a very big difference in how quickly you can get a study done. It also makes a lot more sense so that you have changes that make sense and the changes that get uniformly applied. So to me, it is actually the better patient safety model, but it's been, I've been doing this for many years, managing a really hard time between lawyers in companies trying to protect companies and lawyers in medical centers trying to protect medical centers, and this would be a really novel way and patient oriented way, that I think would be very valuable. So I think the ability to do that is a lot of value.
I know most of the CRMs have worked out IRB reliance or central IRB models within each network, but we're also working on approaches for all of PCornet. So for like Aspen Stray right now, we've been talking about using IRB Share, which is an IRB reliance model. They currently 50 institutions have already signed on and agreed to participate in. But the other important one here is not just with, I can't speak for other institutions, but our institution, the IRB is not our slow point, it's our contracting office that's our horrible slow point. And so doing centralized contracting is the other thing we're trying to be able to offer through this that I think is a huge efficiency.
Yeah, so that's the part that way the money can be spent better on the actual research. The amount it takes to be centralized would be wonderful.
Yeah, I would second that. I would echo your comments with regards to centralized IRB, but I would also say that, you know, having payers buy into a contracting process and have it all centralized, that would be great also.
Yeah. So I don't think anyone would argue that centralizing IRBs and contracting would be a great thing. We've dealt with centralizing our IRBs before across really large studies, and it does make a huge difference. Unfortunately, we have not been able to get one IRB. We usually have two or three central IRBs, so having one would be a great asset. I guess the other thing that would be useful from my perspective, you know, we talked about regulatory barriers, the requirements for data quality. I think there was some conversation about validation of data. The ability to trace back is going to be important if we use it for regulatory purpose. And my question for PCORnet is, what are the plans for developing those relationships yourself with FDA and payers so that they know that data coming out of this network is of a quality that would already be acceptable to them, so it doesn't have to be vetted every time. So we would have that relationship with you as industry. You would already have that relationship with these other external bodies that would understand the level of quality that you're able to produce. It seems like that would be a very useful kind of collaboration for us.
We have to start on that. So, you know, one of our aims for adaptable is that concept of quality by design, so we can demonstrate that, you know, that we have quality data on doing a large trial. And the other thing is just want to make sure we kind of separate quality data doesn't necessarily mean monitoring in terms of what we traditionally think of trial monitoring. So having monitoring go, I say that sodium is 129 as opposed to 130 doesn't to me necessarily illustrate the quality principles we have, right patient, right outcomes, right consent, et cetera, which would be the guiding principles we want. I can say that for adaptable, that, you know, besides people here, certainly FDA will be, you know, interested in how that rolls out and how, you know, what's the type of data, et cetera, that comes through, and also what are the mechanisms that we ensure that, you know, the data that we're using is the data that is of high quality. And it's, if you think about it, I mean, what we're trying to get rid of is the study coordinator that has a screen opened up over here, and then the case report form screen on the right side, and literally, like, copying what's here from the electronic medical record to form or whatever electronics you have. Even that human factor is something that we're trying to get rid of.
So can I just comment on that? And I think that's exactly right. So quality doesn't necessarily equal monitoring. But what I personally would love to see is that other bodies agree with that. So what kind of learning, you know, adaptable, I think will go a long way in that direction to see what level of data come out of that and how convincing and how, even if it's not perfect from a traditional randomized clinical trial standpoint, it should be close enough and large enough to actually give a reliable answer. And what I'd like to see, and I'm sure this is exactly what you're trying to do, is to say, this is a great way of doing trials, get FDA and payers to buy into that. So
the trick we usually use, though, is that especially for phase 3 studies, we go and we meet with the FDA. and we say this is the study, and these are the outcomes, and this is how we're going to measure those critical outcomes, and this is how we'll make sure that that critical part is okay. And we sometimes ask and get permission for not doing things that we think are extraneous. You know, I didn't say this, but you know, the CSA will never say to you, if you do this, I'll give you this. But they would get into a discussion and they would agree about the way you are capturing something. They have standards already on data. So if there's a hope to be, in other words, why bother for you to have to reinvent the wheel? If you can go and use the FDA standards to the extent you need to in the way you capture data, then that means that it'll be much easier to then transfer that data over. So that the FDA not only wants to, you know, see the analysis, but they need to do their own analysis. They've been known to do that as well. So their ability to be able to get data that way. But I think if you could go and engage in a direct conversation, as I was saying, that would be very helpful. Payers may not want to have that level of ability, but they do want to know about certain other things that you do. And it really depends on the payers. And there are certain really big ones that, that may be worth your effort and point speaking directly to.
Yeah, I think that's another excellent comment. The thing about the way FDA handled data, they want the patient-level data. And from what I heard today, you don't do this. This is not the goal in this kind of trial, and that's why some discussion is going to be
more discussion than right.
Well, I guess, so two things on that FDA interaction. So for adaptable, I mean, we're not going for an indication or anything like that. So that kind of one of the mechanisms that she uses, we have not gone through it, but we will have the ability to have FDA interactions in terms of this type of study. What would be required, for instance, for, say, the question that is being raised, either supporting the label, providing supplemental evidence in terms of a label indication, expanding the label, so like say phase four, or addressing a guidance recommendation as part of approval. And just, you know, the examples of diabetes drugs and say proving cardiovascular safety. So like, you know, what are the things that would be requirements for that? The other part in terms of the ultimately, like in terms of the payers and the FDA, like you're pointing out that everyone will have, like, you know, different interests. And so, you know, how that is shared is important. And there is a big principle, I'll turn to my PCORI friends here, in terms of open science and transparency here. And then the second thing is that, like, for these trials, we are getting consent. So that's an important aspect of this. But the for other, and that's where the MAT allows more ease of use of that data, whereas other areas that may, those are observational studies, and so that, you know, will depend on what the type of question is.
So, just a couple of things here that build on what you were talking about, Adrian. I think that what PCORI has been thinking about is at least a two-stage or a two-bucket process. It's either a PCORI sanctioned or a sponsored trial, or it's not. And if it's not, then you saw in the morning Rachel pointing out that 2x2 basically said the standards are different, in terms of what would be required. So if it were a PCORI-NET sponsored trial, there would be certain kind of criteria, presumably, that wouldn't otherwise be required, such as patient-centeredness and the overall that Sue Sharon talked to you about, and patients being involved early in the process and the governance and that, all this sort of stuff. It also may include some open science issues. And so there are issues there as well that would be different depending on what the deal is with PCORI-NET.
So if we're doing a randomized trial, We can do pragmatic trials where we may get a waiver of consent because we're randomizing at the unit level or the clinic level or something like that. But you know, most of the studies or many of the studies will be like the Aspen trial where we're identifying individuals who are eligible, we're consenting them, and we're going to collect patient-level data. So it totally is patient-level data. And I think we have a lot of mechanisms in place for data validity and for being able to track that data back into the original data in the electronic health record. I mean, we can totally do that. These are identifiable patients that have consented to participate in the trial. Even if they're not, we have ways to link back in to de-identified, but we have ways to still link back to confirm if needed. Where we get into trouble is, you know, at least at our site, our survey management tools, our data management tools are not 21 Part 11 compliant because it's expensive to have all of those crazy tools built into the environment to meet the full level of that data. So I think, you know, the question that I have here is when you ask is, you know, is there a way to advocate to the FDA and get them to start recognizing that what we're able to collect is just as valid as moving all of the crazy rules that they have put in, because you're basically, you know, just copying things over to meet the criteria. So can we work with the FDA to loosen some of these rules? If we can't, then the question is, do we have to invest in building out these tools to make ourselves useful to you, or are you comfortable to stay focused on the post-marketing types of studies where you're trying to show comparative effectiveness for the market or for payers and things like that?
I would just encourage everyone to kind of use this type of session to empower the coordinators in terms of issues around this, say, Part 11 compliant. I mean, that was a different era for a different purpose, and I think this is where we have an opportunity to provide some goals here and also pushing change.
So the way that I'm thinking about this as we go through the whole conversation is to recognize that there are some strengths that the Cornet has, and you should be playing to those initially to build up to further capabilities that we're allowed to develop. I think it would be perhaps too challenging and not necessarily wise to think about jumping right into saying we are now going to be a new entity that will allow manufacturers to do phase 3 studies for development of their drugs, for precisely the reasons that you articulated as well, which are the core, in part, the core elements of what the core is about, right, and the patient-centeredness, the openness, and all of that. And also, I would argue that you don't yet, to the extent that you're 13 months old and you're just getting up and going, you don't necessarily have the vested and true proven capabilities of being able to do that sort of thing. And so why fall flat on your face right now as opposed to building up a little bit more slowly, gradually, but methodically to say, here are the things we're really going to try to work on that would satisfy the needs of your customers, if you will, thinking of us as customers, as well as the stakeholders who are forming the networks of the PPRNs and the CRNs.
So I agree with that, but one thing I wouldn't agree with is not bringing it up now, just because
Absolutely.
You have to plan ahead.
Yeah.
And so you agree, you need to take it in steps, but there may be some things that you want to incorporate for your longer-term plan. So I would agree that I wouldn't try to do everything at once, for sure.
Yeah, I'm going to reiterate what Kate said on that, in particular because going to the FDA and going through that process will take you longer than you imagine. And I'm also a big proponent, if you can have foresight, that if you talk to them ahead of time and you can build things the right way, you're not wasting money or time having to rebuild, because my experience has always been in scenarios where we had to change something, it always cost us more, both in manpower and in dollars and in just, you know, frustration, yes. So that's why it is really worth engaging in conversation, especially if you find a way to engage them, not necessarily saying you want to do phase 3, because they will say no, but in terms of finding populations of patients with diseases I think you've done that partly in the diseases you've selected, where this could be invaluable and enable people to get data that they cannot get in a reasonable time frame at a reasonable price today, then that would be our best way in, because in that scenario, I expect they will find the FDA to at least be open to a real dialogue.
Well, along those lines, when there's patient-level informed consent, couldn't you ask them to share that information with FDA after the informed consent? Because as I understand, there's a point of issues and all that. That data is their data, really, right? I mean, and they have cases with the custodians of that, right? And that allows the networks to share those data once they find that. Somebody should evaluate that, I feel.
Yeah, I guess my point in saying about the patient-level data is that when we put in an NDA, we give them all the patient-level data with the NDA.
But if they identify,
based on what I'm hearing today, that would not be the plan for this kind of data to try to extract.
That can be done.
Okay, well,
yeah.
Then.
Yeah, we can. I just want to echo the comments about playing to one's strengths and developing those and to move into more distal areas secondarily. I don't think there are any lawyers in the room here with us right now, but just another thing to think about and maybe just another reason to start in the areas of strength. Is that there also is this whole issue of data ownership, and you know, in particular in the context of a phase 3 study that is very often generating intellectual property in terms of the use of a particular agent for a particular indication is maybe just and that may not be an area that is desirable to really get into, and maybe also does stray from the core mission of the core. So I think it's just another reason to maybe focus more on some of the other questions rather than a phase 3 registration trial.
Yeah, I think it would be just a good exercise to work with us to overlay the kind of the current and emerging capabilities of the CORNET across the drug development lifecycle. So in other words, to really say what would be things that we think could be delivered now. What might be opportunities for the future, and I think that would then give the overarching lifecycle management possibility, and so to really look at both the short-term and also the long-term capabilities.
I think there's a good conversation. I'm not sure I know anything we can do a bit more, because I think we need to avoid the one-size-fits-all mentality that keeps coming up. Not blaming the same thing, but is that it's sort of, well, I think it's a role for CORNET, but it's not. By that I mean, consent can be on various levels. You can consent, and then you can be screened, then you can be recruited, you can be identified, you can be screened in the first phase of that study, and then they may be referred to a center where you then get consent for intervention or for release of further records, etc., all of which is part of the same research enterprise. Similarly, the data level could be at one level of quality of a determined certainty, but I see no reason why this can't lead to, as you said, these patients are consented. You can get their data, they're getting the records just as they do when you come to see the University of Pennsylvania for Spectre Trust, to get the records. So I think a hybrid approach could work. To what extent it's pure procurement versus not, I'm not sure it's going to be a purely tested blend. So some would be 100%, some would be 20%, but that 20% could be quite wide. So I think we're actually doing a disservice if procurement is able to screen and prep the research and get eligible patients that then go to a center for more traditional phase 2B trials. I still think we have to get proper data. We have to get these patients proper. We get FDA level of quality data, whatever that means, we get it right. And I guess I would say, one of the providers says, so what, does that have any of the quality problem and the same controls for the top one at a center? Well, I actually think that we can still use the portal for our patients to report their data. They could still use it to check in certain things. They may have to go to a center to receive the drug or to get certain monitoring. But it gives me a lot of things. So I do foresee, and I'm especially tapping into the CTSA, and people are
that we have a new CTSA program, safety from academic centers in the United States. And for example, there's a way to say that in the laws agreement, you know, if you're interested in actually can be seen quarterly at this place to receive and some of the program will monitor you. Some of this is cost. Most of the things I just mentioned about it all are actually cost savings. So you can incorporate those costs into other ways. So I think we have to be, I like the idea of different levels of consent for different things, different levels of quality of the data, or quality is a bit majority of different levels of detail. I could foresee a variety of approaches. So even with the so-called pragmatic, it's not that easy. And so we get the picture of the list of the biggest details.
So I was wondering, Brian, and many others who are from the Cornet or Chavez, if you can talk about the difference in the distinction between this Cornet sanctioned versus not sanctioned study in terms of what the thinking is to date on the quality, the logistics of doing this. You know, it makes it sound like, you know, one is grade A quality beef and the second is, you know, for fast food or something. So, yeah, I mean, because those of us who are in the industry, I think, would want, you know, if it's a private versus publicly or whatever, just let us know what you're thinking about that.
Well, my thinking is that it needs to be worked out. I haven't been deeply into this discussion, but in a more general sense, I have been, and the basic issue as I see it is that Bitcoin will be risk averse with respect to having its name used to sanction a study if certain gates aren't gone through. And clearly it'll include patient-centeredness, patient engagement processes, and so forth. And that is absolutely, I'm sure, the case. There are still discussions at the highest level, both within PCORI and presumably within PCORINET, regarding open science, which I would imagine would be an issue with the industry. I don't know exactly where the cut points will be there, but others here may.
I had a conversation with Rachel Florence a week ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, in terms of quality, it should be it's the same. So to say it's a PCORINET, if you think about the ultimate vision, it's a public utility that's used by investigators, patients, you know, other stakeholders. So,
right. I mean, I think as an individual CEO and deputy director as well, we strive to provide high-quality services. I think the main difference is when you go to PCORINET, you're gaining access to the national network. And well, most of the CDRNs are regionally focused, so we need creating the capacity to reach across the country. But,
you know, I guess, Peter, the other thing just is also the funding, you know, essentially, you know, how that plays in the part.
Well, I wanted to ask another question.
I need to clarify, because I've actually dealt with this in much of the current study or not, and my understanding of the current language, which was carefully chosen by actually the attorneys at PCORI, among other things, is actually not to me, it's quite the opposite, actually. So it's really particularly geared so that the people in this room are comfortable coming this way. That in fact, you can do what is essentially, I'm not saying it's a distinction without a difference, but it is specifically wanted so that you can come to all the civilians and all the civilians and work in the manner that we've described without some of the restrictions in terms of open source, not just funded by the core per se, which is wouldn't be, without some of those other issues that we might perceive to be a roadblock, although I think they're not. So in fact, it's really the opposite approach. It's not a different, it's actually to allow to do the exact same type of study and just work broadly as PCORINET. So I know it's a problem for PCORINET's face to the world, but that's a different issue. So the purpose of this language was to allow the industry to feel comfortable doing things using all of the resources of PCORINET. It's just, whether you call it PCORINET or for PCORINET or not, it's really the only difference. Why would you call it that or not?
Right, so you wouldn't want to call it that if you were stuck with some of the methodologic issues and open science and need to publish things. Well, I actually think it's becoming a disincentive to call it a PCORINET study. And I think the people in this room, the
our surveys would probably not want that herb, and you get the same provisions otherwise. And that's, I've talked to Rachel about this, that's the way it's playing out. And I think the pecorino versus not pecorino presents an inside internal branding issue for us to deal with, how you give credit, and I say also the pecorino is a part of it. And I think it's not an issue that, this group needs to worry about in that way.
Yeah, it's interesting because I had the same question that came up in my mind when you mentioned it. And, you know, in terms of publishing, we publish our trials within 9 months of finishing. So that's not an issue. It has to be published. It's just the way it is. So I don't think that's going to be a major difference. And I didn't know if it was like having the ADR on your toothpaste or something like that, whether it carries some kind of advantage externally, or is it really more for you all to understand the
variety? You will give it some action around your premature because there will be a vetting process for projects that are taken on by the PCORNET and sent out to the sites.
I would just say that this is an evolving policy, and so like I think that's probably one of the things is actually what are the things that would be strict requirements and so forth, and again, it's trying to make sure that there's...
Well, the most important part is whether it gets the seal of approval or it doesn't. You would address
one of the same seal of approval.
I think it's going with
One thing I think it does point out, which is that there probably needs to be better clarity around what this means. So.
Yeah, I think we should move on to another subject. I just wanted to say if that is a measure that you are going to make and it has an impact on what studies you are going to actually agree to run, then that's just something to consider. So,
I think one request, too, would be maybe that when you hit a point where you've vetted enough internally, we'd be happy to review and give you feedback. And, you know, if that ends up, when you get to that point, that it might be useful, or so certainly so that we understand, you know, what's involved at the right time.
I'm going to ask a new question, I guess, in the area. When we are building our studio and becoming it, I mean, one of the areas we focused on was that it might be advantageous for groups is the types of outcomes data that we can collect on patients over time. So, you know, one of the thoughts was that by doing a study through pre-Cornet, you can do very large studies at lower cost where you can reach huge numbers of patients and not just have to rely on surrogate outcomes. You could potentially look at hard clinical outcomes, and not just on blood pressure or A1C, but you could actually get, you know, hospitalizations, cardiovascular events, and so forth. Then the second area was the ability to follow patients longitudinally for a long period of time after they consented to the study, at least electronically, very cheaply. So, you know, even if you were a truly funded study for 3 years, we can potentially follow that patient for 10 years or 15 years if they've consented, because we can continue to pull their data electronically, both claims data and EHR data, and really look at long-term outcomes. And then the third area was this ability to actually contact patients over time for PROs, which could include issues around quality of life, but also treatment satisfaction and adherence. And so, you know, my question is, if any of those three areas sort of resonate with the group as areas that we should be focusing on or should be building our tools as things that you guys might want to be able to access for studies.
I think there's sort of a meta type of study, and I'm not sure if I'm using that word correctly, but you know, for many diseases, there's this question about what actually does matter to patients. You know, and there's been some really surprising
data that are completely like in psoriasis, patients who use the POSI scores, those patients don't care about, they only care about what's on their face and their hands. And they don't want, in the treatment of migraine, you know, key endpoint is, you know, pain-free. Most patients say, oh, that's too unrealistic, I don't really care about that. I'm interested in other facets. So those are the kinds, you know, doing work, you know, leveraging these networks, leveraging the clinical trial situation to really help us as a broader community understand what really does matter to patients, I think would be something that quite valuable.
Is that a question?
Is
that something that
you're showing? Yeah, I mean, so actually, is that, so one of the things, particularly the PPRNs bring to this, is very easy access to lots of patients who are very interested in talking about those kinds of issues. But where Peter was going, is this something, how would the PPRNs interact with the industry around that?
If somebody has an answer, that's great. I guess what I was going to answer is that, yes, we are very interested in that, and there's a lot of other industries cropping up around that, about what matters to patients and, you know, how to follow them longitudinally. Look at patients like me, 23andMe. There are all kinds of things going on. You could play in that space as well with your PPRNs, depending on what you're collecting, what your abilities are. So that's another piece in terms of sort of
the different pieces. We do it often through the wonderful patient portal.
We talked about earlier about different pieces. We were talking about this earlier. One of the things that I'm interested in is getting those patient insights. Could we utilize the PPRNs or the CDRNs to do that, not even as part of a clinical trial?
Right. So one of the things, just so our PPRN is, our PPRN and CDRN are establishing a sort of routine process for working through both PRO priorities and study priorities. Very, very inclusive. Includes patients, doctors, families, with hundreds of people participating, that we're going to start deploying to pretty much any disease group cluster that starts working with us.
So you can get to follow up, I mean, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we can do that as a resource we can provide to it. We're at the RCT group right now, but we're happy to help just identify a group of patients with a condition of interest, contact them, and either electronically survey them, phone survey them, or even bring them in for focus group types of activities. We run what are called community engagement studios, where we bring in an independent facilitator, and we actually get input from patients from the community to help, you know, guide a research project. So we definitely, this comes back to Peter's comment before, it doesn't have to be like an all or none. You know, we do the RCT or not. Or, you know, I think we're trying to build an array of services that could be of value to groups.
I guess I'll just put a notation that this would fall under sanitary research queries, and so optimization of protocols, for instance. So, and so that would be very much in line of what we do. And so I think that can be noted.
I'm going to call it preliminary research. So I think creating these assets that,
you know, that ultimately being used for like a trial, ultimate trial.
No, I think just to get the core part, you know, I think it's important to realize that we provide, for this instance, much more than just access to patients. We actually have patients who are now with trained cadre of patients who understand investigation much more than we did so many years ago. That has been part of our group, for example, for outcome measure development. And even, it's, you know, we've all come to the Pecorin group, but it's great to be able to message to patients, to have you ask these questions and to go through some patients. You know, it's like, don't ask about it, no, you know, what are we talking about? Ask it like this. And it makes a difference. We have the expertise, we have the patients. So I think this is the type of thing we can do. It's not in our trials, as you mentioned, but it's important. So this is something of importance. And I think phrasing it in terms of a particular drug or a particular pathway is perfectly fine. You know, if you're developing asthma, you know, medication, or then you want to understand more about those needs, I think that's an opportunity. So I think that's the kind of thing we certainly can do, probably now, with a lot of methodology.
If an endpoint's going to really be accepted, the more people that actually use it,
That's key, and I think that's one of your other key successes. You had mentioned about what you can, what data you can do well.
Yeah.
I think that's really important, because you don't want a study that failed because it was data that couldn't be captured well in the type of environment and setting you're doing, but rather that it really gave you information on the drug.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, because the more an endpoint is used, the more likely it's going to change clinical practice, right? So it's part of the mission, I think, here.
So one of the things to think about is which concerns PICRONET and close PCORIN and the methodology committee, and on the list you could include not only the PRO issue, but patient preferences, which is maybe a subset of PROs, I suppose it should be, certainly. But also the standards for a pragmatic clinical trial, because my understanding, and I think I have it correct, is that not many people know what really is a pragmatic, agree on a pragmatic clinical trial. In my sense is, if you've seen one pragmatic clinical trial, you've seen one pragmatic clinical trial. But it's a very important issue, especially since what we're talking about are pragmatic clinical trials in the real world comparative trials. The methodology committee that PCORA has put together is a pretty substantial committee that has some standing, and it is something that you could also want PCORA to tackle specifically, especially as it interfaces with PCORNET and PCORNET studies.
So can I explore that a little bit? So when people around this table think of a pragmatic clinical trial, do you think of a trial where a patient comes in, signs a consent, and then just goes and is monitored electronically, or is there an intervention and can be randomized? Could there be other interventions? And we collect data from EHR, but maybe some other ways? What is the thinking around this table?
Actually, one other question about that, because you at the very beginning said pragmatic clinical trials are conceptually easy but hard to implement, and I thought that was a very interesting notion, because, you know, by its nature, it's supposed to be easier to implement, but the barriers to get that is probably the issue.
Well, that's what's being built right now, is being able to do it in a reliable way, but it also depends on what you're calling a pragmatic trial. So as I alluded to earlier, we're running a pragmatic clinical trial. It is a randomized trial at pre-launch of a medicine that has subsequently been approved, but the trial is still ongoing, comparing to usual care, and we're collecting things, information via a EHR, as well as linkage to pharmacy records, and we don't see the patient again. So it's kind of a mixture of different ways of doing this. So I come back to the question that Brian, you brought up, is what do you feel is a pragmatic clinical trial, or is it a spectrum that...
Well, I think it's kind of a spectrum. The determinant is terrible, but it's used all the time. There's trials that are embedded into the healthcare system. The patients don't even know the drug works because it's different. The standard of care is improved. There are people who need an active consent. There's trying to avoid the need for the individual practitioner to do consent. It's unit-based. It's group-based. And then it goes to the other end of the outcomes. If you actually put something else in the measure, some of the organizational practice, that's not going to go. It has to be what's already in the chart. I think it's available. I think we have the capability of doing effectiveness research in the world and pragmatic research. And again, if you apply the purity test, you'll have very few studies done. But if you are flexible about what levels you need, I think you can get bigger studies done.
So, Brian, what's the purpose of using the term? What's the likelihood of using the term of a pragmatic clinical trial if it's very variable? And if it doesn't necessarily affect what you're doing, why does it make a difference to call it a pragmatic clinical trial versus something else, a randomized controlled clinical trial?
I
So the traditional site-based interventional study is not a dogmatic study. There's things that sort of are not. The question is, how far do you go before it's a pragmatic? And I think there are pragmatic aspects that we very much want to refuse to perform. I mean, I think certainly the Aspen trial has several of those aspects. You want to describe that?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, so you can actually calculate a pragmatic index, so and a tool, so we can talk about that later, but I think what you're pointing out is that you were building a network that is highly generalizable in the real world, answering those types of questions. So by its nature, the population should represent the population that's going to be ultimately treated and informed by evidence, and that the inclusion-exclusion criteria or things are readily available in terms of medical care. The follow-up is also readily available, although it could be supplemented based on the needs of the question. Again,
from the engagement is low. They're not engaged as researchers.
Right, right. So this is part of practice. The other thing is just to distinguish patient-level trials versus cluster randomized trials. I mean, one of the things that at least I'm hoping that we get out of this is that we've talked about some of the potential uses of patient-level trials. So phase four type studies, things that would be supportive of evidence or supportive of a label in the phase four, or payers or other stakeholders. And especially since there's different groups here representing health services, and so that kind of combination of outcomes research and health services research during pragmatic cluster randomized trials, is that of interest to people around the table? So, it's okay if someone says,
what you don't like about it?
Yeah, I mean, so then what you were talking about, things that would be, say, again, you have different options for different standards of care that could actually be randomized at a site or a cluster, or different therapeutic options. And so, like, if you were to think about just the classic examples, people getting randomized to different co-pays or different formularies that have different practices.
Yeah, no, I think that there's a great deal of interest across the industry right now in pragmatic clinical trials of one type or another, and so I think you've heard it around the table from several of us. To answer Brian's question, I think engaging the CORI methodology committee would be very helpful from my point of view, because to the extent that, and we're in a very, as you've heard, very regulatory-driven, very standards-driven industry, to the extent that we can really clarify what it is, at least that spectrum of designs and what would be the best and most appropriate practices around that would be extremely helpful for us, obviously, in terms of the arguments that we will ultimately make to the users of the data that we have. It would be very nice to have that in my response.
Yeah, I think, again, it also depends on what question you're trying to answer. So if you're trying to answer a question about really rare events and you need 50,000 patients, then your technique may be a little bit different than something that's a little bit more common where you need to validate a PRO, but it still could be pragmatic. So, I mean, I don't know that you're going to, and I think everyone's agreeing to this, is that we're not necessarily looking for a specific definition, but it may be worthwhile to define sort of the general principles around
that. Yeah, another way to put it, the first 45 minutes you talked about data and standardized data and data that would be coming out of PCORnet that would be acceptable to decision makers, to include the FDA and so forth. What I was wondering if you wanted to put on the table, and I think we are, is design, design issues, because when we're talking about a different dimension of the design, when you're talking about cluster real-world trials, whether we call them pragmatic or not, there are clear design issues that are highly variable, just like the data is highly variable when you get into real-world situations. I'm not sure whether we spoke about the level of the actual exposure if you have patient-level randomization, right? So what's the clinical there? Do we have infrastructure for that? Is there a trial pharmacy or anything like that in those? Or Andrew, how do you do that? And Kate, you mentioned you just encounter a patient at the beginning and then you don't have any encounters anymore. So how do they receive the medication of interest?
So yes, we have to have good exposure, good outcomes, and good data. So in the ASPR study, it has open label, and then patients actually will not only get their aspirin as they routinely do, but they can dose over the counter based on that. Future studies certainly can deliver drugs depending on where they stand within labels, so that can be done usually at the practice site, for instance. Things that are in phase 3 or something else that would be different, then you have to go through a different mechanism. But you know, we have examples where we've done central drug delivery for trials are in phase 3 or in phase 4. So phase 3 usually is more of an issue in terms of drug accountability, and that's where it starts hitting all sorts of regulatory issues.
Yeah, I was thinking we can report a continuum for those studies, and some will be highly pragmatic, where patients may even have choose their intervention, where you really are back into clinical care. But I mean, for a lot of them, I think they are mixing in some of the usual components of a traditional clinical trial. So where you're randomizing a patient to treatment A versus treatment B, you probably have the provider engaged, but at least in that initial assignment, I think where there may be differences, often we don't have a super strict study protocol after that that's being followed, like around titration of the medicine or something like that. We're giving much more leeway to the provider to follow through with usual care. So there might be a lot more crossover or other things that just typically happen in usual care. We've talked about in one study giving vouchers to patients for study drug that they could then take to a local pharmacy, because we didn't want to bring cost in as a factor for why a patient may or may not take one of the two drugs that they were being assigned to.
Examples of, say, this is where you can actually use co-pays, for instance, or drug vouchers. And so because by its nature it's confined in the U.S., we don't have as many problems as one would have if it was outside the U.S. where that becomes a bigger
issue. Because aspirin is over the counter, so you don't record this in the pharmacy dispensing record.
No, but that's part of the medical record, because every time a patient comes in to their health care encounter, they actually have med reconciliation. But that, I think for future studies, I think that's an important issue that you're bringing.
So we can go back to giving drugs. And so I actually think we can do both. I think you can still have the University of Pennsylvania Research Pharmacy would do a lot of big studies, but you can still be the distributor, and you could use all that or whatever you want to use to distribute. I think as I'm thinking about things, one of the key semi-pragmatic issues is that our patients consent to us. And the central consenting is one body that closes, which is different, by the way, from the Reliance Agreement, where you still have to go through individual institutions and then go to the Reliance, so it's centralized. And taking the individuals, the patient's physicians, out of the picture as an officially engaged in research provider is key. Because if that person is not engaged in research, but just providing information because they've consented with us, That's very important. That's much different than having all these different sites. So again, let's say we're doing a phase 4 study about bezafibrate for something and for associated vasculitis. We can get into it with those three. The patient's consent, they are wherever they are. They get the data to another quality, and we can't sacrifice on that. But the information they provide goes straight to us. They can get it from the physicians. That physician doesn't have to be GCP doesn't have to go through all those other aspects. We are the study physicians. And I don't even want to get that clear, but I think there's really different ways of doing this that are that take advantage of it, because we have to have a value added to people that why come to us and do this if it's just that we're currently working for something else. So I think the question is, can it be greater volume? Can it be more efficient? Can it be quicker? And can we do something, and even better, can we do something we wouldn't otherwise be able to do? And I think, I like to explore some of those options. Maybe we should get away from the phase three, but some of these aftermarket studies, phase four, whether it be safety or label extension, that is really doing the best that are often terrible if you just wait for physicians to report things. No, I mean, phase four reporting is terrible. We need real data, and so, you know, where does that resonate? How, you know, what kind of pressures do you have to first get some of the safety data and to also explore what is being really done in the use of these drugs?
That's the point I was trying to make with regard to taking what you currently have that's unique about where you are and your organization as a network that would be useful for us, if you think of us from the industry perspective, in terms of the offerings. And here's the patient relevance as well, the unique opportunities to collect data that you wouldn't maybe necessarily have access to otherwise. And think about building up those capabilities that way in terms of the offerings, as opposed to saying, we're coming in to try to do a registration, you know, a new registration CRO or something like that, because that wouldn't necessarily be as useful for us immediately. And the other point I would bring up is I think you have a unique position to leverage your voice with the FDA in a manner that can be beneficial to us with regard to helping them understand both new, well, begin to understand, and, you know, the longest journey begins with just one step, don't forget. But the idea of us is not that far away. Yeah, that's much like a mental journey, but the idea is helping them understand the novelty of these new methods. So think of a pragmatic clinical trial. What are you doing? Don't perform necessarily hard and fast, and maybe have an index or whatever. FDA is miles away from understanding that and the utility and the benefits of it. The same thing is with all the phase four observation research that we do, which many of us around the world would probably think we do different quality. And they would argue is that for any quality, though, and you can't trust that. So this is where PCORNET can actually help and intercede, if you will, by saying, we have these really fancy researchers who have vetted this, whether it's a PCORNET sanction or whatever, to help them say that this is, in fact, a good study to be doing.
And just one other comment on that. I just wanted to second that again, or third it or fourth it, because I think it's come up several times.
Yeah.
Like having those conversations now with FDA, with payers, I think would be really useful. You talked about it, what are some of the next steps. I think that's one of them. Because, FDA, from a straight clinical trial standpoint, agree, it's a long way off and may never happen. But from a safety standpoint, I think they'd be very willing to listen and very interested in these data. So
the advice would be, this is something we would get input on. I might say, if the quarter says for COVID, this is the high priority, we would be interested to at least generate those questions. Is this an interest sort of a working group that needs to come out of this to generate what are the three or four issues to consider what FDA is performing about in those veterans and sites within the core group?
Yeah, so one thing that's going to be of interest, I believe, to at least us and other bodies outside of here, including regulatory agencies and payers, I just have to bring this up because I didn't get a chance to ask it early, taking the aspirin trial as an example, you're comparing two doses of aspirin, but there's no benchmark of what happens if you don't take aspirin. So you don't know, say they're equivalent. You don't know if they're being efficacious, and you don't actually even know if you can surmise what the background rate would be of the bleeding or of other things. So I think that's going to be something. No, it's not a simple question, but it is something that we get challenged with all the time in terms of, okay, solely high dose, and you don't have to answer this question, I'm just bringing it up as a potential question. High dose has more bleeds than low dose, which has some bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
but is that similar to people who don't take any aspirin at all? Or, and again, I'm not asking for an answer, it's just a question that could come up. So this leads to a couple of questions on my part. Would there ever be a potential for a treatment versus standard of care or versus nothing? And how would we as a group want to test, you know, what another possible pilot could be, bearing that in mind? So it could be that that's not important, whether, you know, you have, whether standard of care. So it gets back to a number of questions. What is a pragmatic trial? Part of that could be a new treatment versus an old standard of care, or it could be something else. So,
two things. From my guess, from the FDA perspective, that they would believe much more in the evidence for a randomized trial than an observational study. So getting to the
efficacy, for sure.
On the safety side, in part because they've never really had a lot of access to large trials that were in the real world, and that they had to use other means, such as Sentinel and other aspects in terms of pharmacovigilance, because that was what's in the real world. So I agree with you in terms of, like, they haven't, that they, on the safety side, they focus on what they have best available because it's a large set, and they're also looking for sometimes rare safety events. But in terms of on the efficacy and effectiveness side, certainly they would probably have more reliance on the idea that randomization is God's gift here. And so I think to your question about, you know, background therapy and exposure leading up to an intervention, you know, hopefully randomization would take care of that. In terms of potential studies or to evaluate new therapy versus nothing, you know, that's certainly in the realm of effectiveness therapy, comparative of standard of care that includes something minimal, for instance, or new therapies. The other thing is that it's always amazing to hear the different iterations of therapy. So, like for the aspirin study, there were 26 different iterations originally of what you could do because of enterocoded, you know, with warfarin, with NOAX, you know, day or night, you know, all these different things. So, but ultimately, I was selected to two lengths. But.
So, getting back to the question, what other work could be done? What is another kind of pilot that could be the next step, do you think? What would you like from an industry perspective? Because there are already a couple of pilots starting up from the PCORnet perspective. From an industry perspective, what would you want to see demonstrated?
It's okay to be audacious. I mean,
yeah.
This pilot...
PCORnet, understand what are the needs of industry? You know, throw the word pilot out. What else do you want to see?
I'm asking this really question for a minute. I mean, it's not really patient-centered or the women's divisions, but, I mean, the other big area for consideration in business for women's to health economics or just, you know, impact on cost to the healthcare system. And I don't know if this is within the domain of the core or not, but if it were, that also is an area of exploration that would be very nice. I mean, there's a difference between what the core is going to fund and other funder might want to fund or sponsor within PCORnet. So I don't think that you should think of yourselves as being constrained from that standpoint. I do think that you need to be concerned about, I mean, to go back to what I had said earlier, that
you got knocked off a little bit, but if you want this to be labeled as a PCORnet sponsored, you know, with a mentor of PCORnet, then PCOR is going to be a lot more interested in a number of things, not only the patient-centeredness, but also that it's actually comparative, that the comparator makes sense to real-world decision-makers, and so forth. I think that's the case. But if you want to fund a study that collected costs and collected utilization that didn't, that simply utilized the network separate from the PCORnet study per se, I think that's all over the table. First, I'm concerned. First, I think the court is concerned. Mm-hmm. Does anybody else have
a question? What?
I was not trashing the phase 4 studies done by industry. I was actually talking about the post-marketing reporting that physicians do for especially the off-label. Others than especially the diseases is, I think, terrible. But,
spontaneous reporting.
Yes, spontaneous reporting is terrible. So, actually, what is it you're interested in? We don't have to make sure about the trials because we're in the trials group, and I think we can do biomarker studies. We can do lots of things, actually. You'd be surprised what we can do if you get those patients. I'd be interested in what is resonating with personalized medicine. I've talked about trying to get, these families that have different forms of vasculitis, and if we can I'm going to go to a trial. We find those. There's needles in the haystack. We find them. Send them to our partners. We'll do, we'll torture their DNA.
So from my perspective, one of some of the things that we are wrestling with, and it is a regulatory standpoint, but I think that would not have an impact on the kind of data, is how do we collect their events. So, there's an interest in cardiovascular events with medicines to treat diabetes. There's an interest in asthma-related events in patients treated with long-acting beta agonists. These are very rare and require large numbers of patients. That could be done in a very pragmatic way because the endpoint is pretty definitive, right? So you wouldn't necessarily need to have a great deal of follow-up. You just need to have a cohort of patients on the medicine and a cohort of patients who are not on that medicine.
So targeting phase 4, targeting safety questions, or changing safety questions.
I'll put just an example case so there's a lot of interest in obesity. Obviously that's one of the big areas for big hornet, and no pun intended, I guess, but and there's a lot of interest in therapeutic development for obesity, both device as well as pharmaceutical-based. But one of the key things that comes up is safety around that. So like to actually have a large enough trial to evaluate, say, cardiovascular safety, you wind up, because the population being targeted typically is in their 20s, 30s, or 40s, you have, really outsized sample sizes of, 25 to 50,000. And so, that's an extreme case in terms of, unmet need. Some questions in terms of, how can you be assured in the post-market environment you can pick up those types of rare events. And also, let's see, believability of an observational study like that because of prior examples where there have been drugs that have passed the marketing threshold in terms of getting approval, but then post-market discover issues later. So, the diabetes is another example where the guidance was envisioning originally pragmatic studies, but then everyone started hanging ornaments on the tree, and and they're able to fall. Where it falls, clinicians, industry, regulators, everyone's at fault in terms of that.
So I've got a question. Those of you from industry here are working with commercial competitive companies, obviously. If there are things dancing in your brain, thinking, I know what I'd like to ask the court to do, I don't know, say in front of anybody.
I was looking at this as an opportunity where we're all able to come together because you are here, because otherwise I would get in trouble if Spinwell went to dinner right now and had a debate on how to do that privately. So I've been focused more on the opportunity to have really good collaboration both from academic side and the industry side. So I haven't been getting that from industry outside.
So I have some very specific ones, but you may.
Sure, I just wanted to expand a little bit on what you were talking about in terms of just identifying subsets or target patients. And I also spoke about this this morning as well, but just this whole concept that we do phase 3 studies, we look at needs, we get drugs approved, and then we kind of scratch our heads and say, actually, okay, we've got this drug. Who actually is the real target patients? Who are the ones that really benefit, and where can we extract the greatest value? And that's just the essence. I understand there are lots of subsets, but in any point, sometimes it needs to be specifically enriched for a specific purpose. And it's not just genetics, it's probably also epigenetics, as well as many other factors or other surrogates that may reflect and just in terms of themes, but that is something that it's less about comparative effectiveness and more about the use of an agent and trying to determine who does well and who doesn't do well, and what factors are associated with better response versus less. That's about better chance. Exactly. Articulate this is the patient who is going to do really well on this specific agent, and that would be enormously valuable.
I'm adding into that because in the phase 3 clinical trials, we're powered to get the endpoints we needed for the approval, and we typically don't have adequate power to really understand which we think is probably very valuable information. So the ability, though, to then get that kind of information in a pragmatic, more cost-efficient way as well raises the ability to be able to do that and to actually get that kind of information. So I think it's probably a lot of information.
So, Brian, to your question about is there something that there's a need for, I think that's what you said, that you don't want to say, and I'm not representing the industry when I say that, but I'll just point out one huge area of need that I think we all have is our medication to inform, information to inform medication use in pregnancy in my patient. And, of course, the FDA is now getting ready to change its labeling for pregnancy in my patient, but that's a significant challenge that all healthcare providers face, and there's very little that we've been able to do about it so far.
Just by way of information around some of the resources that some of the networks are developing, one of the things that we're developing is call it out of one or citizen health science for individuals to track any symptom they want, any PRO they want, any measure, any sensor they want on a continuous basis, and integrate it with the EMR and feed it back to the patient or the doctor. So those kinds of tools are things that we're working on that would enable these kinds of individualized therapy.
And one other thing that we're really interested in, and I agree that treatment, heterogeneity of treatment is a huge one, as well as adherence and whether improved adherence actually has any impact on outcomes is big for us.
What level of adherence are they actually doing? So it's sort of the flip side of, is it adherence around, but actually, what's really happening out there? What are they really taking? You might know that from prescription counts, but for some other things, it's actually not the reason. I have a different question, if I may. What
I had to put my hands on, which is half of the PPR items are focused on rare diseases, orphan diseases in the United States, and of course there are 6,000 to 7,000 of those, and they have increased detention by those who couldn't be supposed to be small. What are any sort of ideas about how to approach research in rare diseases through becoming it that is attractive or problematic? I mean, I think there's great advantages because you have a wide range of people you can try to find those people. Of course, they're still rare. And so it creates different challenges if you do this from them. Any thoughts about rare disease research from your standpoint, how this may have added value?
So I would be very interested in that for some of the stuff that we're looking at particularly. And the benefit that I would see that could come from the Cornet is the ability to, in a relatively or supposedly standardized manner, gather all of this information with regard to the common data model and then what we have put in place and the information to collect that, as well as being able to, and this goes back to, I missed part of the PLR discussion before, but going back to adding information that is truly relevant to patients. I don't know if the point was made here before, but all these instruments that we use are relevant to researchers, right? They're easy to score, they're easy to get a quality from, you can do all that kind of measure. That necessarily is relevant to patients. And so if we can come up with now all these new wearable technologies and things that are there that you might have access to because of the networks that you've got available to you, that would be really informative for us in a way of looking at that.
Just make the point to clarify what I think you're getting at. It's actually serves to measures and domains. So speaking of ideas, this is an opportunity to find out what domains are of importance to patients. How to measure it is a different challenge. But from the rest standpoint, you're making a good point.
No, well, I think, I sit on the Rare Disease Advisory Panel with PCORI. And I would say from the rare disease perspective, the ability to access EMR-level data to look to screen for rare diseases, I don't think I need to really elaborate on the potential there. From an industry perspective, that would be, tremendous in terms of furthering rare disease research. Going back, I think, to some of the other questions, we use all kinds of tools, market research early on for patient preferences. And I think one of the disconnects, and I'll defer to others probably with more experience in this than I do, but one of the disconnects I think we've seen is a disconnect between some of that early patient preference testing that we see and, some of the later screening that we see when we get into phase 3 and even post-market. And I think the ability to have a single data set available that could potentially bridge that gap and close probably that gap. I think that would be, in terms of our pie-in-the-sky bucket list, that would be a tremendous opportunity, I think, that PCORNET has.
Cultural acceptance and participation in clinical trials, and it really varies in therapeutic areas. So oncology is kind of an outlier. Everyone, ultimately gets involved in the clinical trial. I work in a lot of trials in the psychiatry area, and it's very difficult. And what ultimately happens, actually, is that you get that it seems to be a mega for professional patients, and you get getting the absolute wrong people into the trials. And there's a way just throughout this process, and because the reach is so large, to really change the way that we think about participating in clinical trials, but also I think would serve a broad benefit for everybody, patients, and all of us, making that more part of our accepted culture.
Yeah, actually, I'm glad you brought that up because that's kind of a key theme in terms of the PCORNET and the clinical engagement, the patient engagement, is that how can we change the culture there? And you actually see it in different ways. So some physicians will feel ownership of patients, and so have limited access. And then the other part is that when you actually survey patients, they definitely are interested in contributing, but the time you insert the word realization, then there's a worry about being a guinea pig. So I certainly think that linkage to
rare disease registries, which was talked about, was very important. And I think if the court could really, and the coordinates could help us to really modernize, if you will, the concept of registries, what types of endpoints would be most
important. We are essentially a registry. I've 700 patients are going to for thousands of patients as far as we are. In the health registry, we've got informal registrants. Many people have used patient advocates group registry lists to enroll these people. So these are super registrants, and they're providing this information. What do you want to do with that list?
The question is really, obviously, it's quite difficult for industry to really create these registries themselves. Can we really collaborate more effectively in the development process? Can we identify, as the point had been made before, heterogeneous treatment response, how to optimize the treatment? Can we understand what types of aspects of patient experience are most important? I think that's all central to really evolving the culture, if you will, around understanding registries and enhancing and modernizing those. I do think also, and to some extent this is another aspect of heterogeneity of treatment response, if we can, I can see a real value potentially in helping to understand appropriate utilization, identifying patients once products are really in the marketplace, to understand that best and or optimal response. The term computable phenotypes, I think, was used in some of the prior presentations. How do you really effectively identify those patients using the means that we have, and then understand utilization? I think that's really an important opportunity.
You guys, how do people feel about research regarding off-label use? Because there's an awful lot of that going on out there. You have to be careful what are you allowed to look at, what do you want to look at. It's certainly dealing with autoimmune diseases, there's a great deal of extension of lines of the label.
Well, certainly I think it would be potentially useful to understand from a hypothesis-generating perspective what's out there, what's being done, and what the efficacy is. Obviously, it's certainly not randomized. It's very highly selected, especially probably in the vasculitis area, highly selected group of people that are being chosen for off-label use of
that.
I would hope that as a physician, if you're going to get something off-label, you're going to choose the patient where you think that benefit risk is going to be worthwhile. Now, also, it's good to understand what the level of use is, but, obviously it cannot be perceived as promoting an off-label use. So in that context, it has to be done very carefully.
Right. So your point is valid. If it helps be hypothesis-generating more, so you really got some data to make it worth doing a clinical trial, and if you have the network of patients, that may be the great way to roll that over. And then, yes, we would go. I mean, remember, everything that we did prior to phase 3 and approval was off-label. So we would do novel research in that area as a way to say that we can do an
intellectual observational research. We don't know, but we would really do that. I mean, the comparative effectiveness trial with some trying to address some confounding by indication, obviously, but there's also just statistical approaches we can do, especially if we can do this nationally and get a larger sample size.
One thing about the off-label part, so like you say, there is an ability to have interactions with FDA regarding whether an IND is needed or not, and so I think this would be in the realm of what we could do for the coronet, and certainly that would fall into place here. So.
Depends on how rare we are looking at it. As, just like in the oncology world, things that get approved, you would have required much larger studies in another type of a disease.
This has been a very useful conversation. We're getting close to the end, but one of the purpose of today was to open a begin a conversation around these sorts of things, and Bicornet is all about engagement. So one of the final questions I think should be, how would you like to remain engaged in this conversation? Because this is, as you can tell, a network that's getting formed. We're only 13 months into it. What would make sense to participate in the formation of what will be hopefully a resource?
So that gets back from, in my mind, a little bit to the logistics questions that we're talking about. What is anticipated with the Cornell Center? I mean, as was pointed out earlier, I think Joe and Brian were saying this in the larger session, many of us have interactions, research interactions with an individual CRN or a PPRN or however we're looking at that now. But to the extent that we might want to amplify or broaden our engagement, how do we go about doing that? That's the part that's not really clear to me, at least. It's not quite as simple or satisfactory to say, put up the phone and call somebody in the coordinating center, because that's,
What we anticipate, and Rich talked about the front door, is just basically being able to facilitate that interaction, so collecting inquiries and coordinate that. So, for example, one reason for doing that, say, after today, there are 20 people who are interested in obesity, and so how do you ensure that that's coordinated to meet everyone's needs? The same example someone mentioned about issues in pre-competitive environment, how to ensure that we are able to do that, but that sounds like that's something we'll need to more clearly specify in terms of how to get through that.
Well, let me follow up on what Peter was saying, which is, I don't think you've been on the spot, but we go back to this group. I think I said that this was a good conversation, but I was actually very encouraged by this. And the question is, would this group be interested in doing this again in 3 months? So go ahead and say, what have you done since then? And we're going to turn over to this to solve all the problems we're going to do with the FDA, and because we're going to But honestly, this is remember each time, and it seems like there's some dialogue here. We can set up a conference call and just sort of go back out and see what ends up. And this one's people seem to be
not about that. I think that would be good. Actually, since where we are toward the end, almost to the end of the time, I guess maybe a few next steps like that, or any other burning questions. A few next steps, and then we're going to have to figure out how to present this back to the whole group. But I'm hearing general agreement that, having sort of an ongoing conversation would be worthwhile. Anyone disagree? Okay. So any other burning questions before or issues before we tie it all together?
Only other thing, and some people may say that's or disagree, but often the line is helpful to have use cases that can be illustrated to. So you mentioned adherence. That's a common question that I think comes up across industry that's important. So, what are the right interventions for that, or development of PROs, But anyway, any examples of people after they leave here of use cases that say that's come up in their own work or their own company's work, that if we only had this, and that would be the use case. So,
can I just clarify, what would you say a use case is? So adherence is important to us. Do you want what we're doing about it, or just that is one?
Use cases would be studies that either you're currently doing or would have done if you were able to have infrastructure like the Cornet. And it can be disease-based, or it can be drug-based. So any of this, or use cases like that.
Right. So we're going to reconvene, actually, and see if there's something.
Yeah, I think so.
Do you want me to put a sign-up around here?
Yeah, we could do a sign-up sheet if you want.
Maybe that's
okay.
started off several, I guess, going around the table, there'll be, what do you want, name and serial number, name and email?
I think name, your company, your institution, and your email.
We have emails on the company for everyone.
We should have sent you more than that. Just don't have your name.
So we're going to get cleared right now and then we'll reconvene in the general session.
The next item is a 20-minute break.
Nice job, everybody.